This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 1971, Jonathan Shapiro was a young lawyer with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. He'd already been working for several years on civil rights cases when he was asked to take on a new client, a man who happened to be the heavyweight champion of the world.
And all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemies are white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Well, in April 1967, Muhammad Ali refused to be drafted into the U.S. Army and to fight in the Vietnam War. Ali claimed conscientious objector status on the basis of his religion. As a consequence, he was stripped of his heavyweight title, banned from boxing, convicted of draft evasion, and faced a prison sentence. Ali appealed his conviction. The case reached the Supreme Court in 1971, and that's when Ali's lawyer, Chauncey Eskridge, turned to Jonathan Shapiro at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for help. Well, today, Jonathan Shapiro is a partner at the Boston law firm Shapiro, Weisberg & Guerin. He came into our studios a little earlier this afternoon to talk about what it was like to fight on behalf of Muhammad Ali. And note, this conversation features one piece of historical tape that contains a racial epithet. Jonathan Shapiro began by telling us why he joined Ali's legal team and the major issues that were at stake.
Ali had been drafted by a draft board from which blacks had been systematically excluded. There just were no blacks on any draft boards in the Deep South, including Kentucky. And we thought that that was just like the juries from which blacks had been excluded, where we raise these issues every day, and we thought it was equally applicable to draft boards. Uh-huh. Another one of the issues was the persecution of the black Muslims.
Well, then there was also, in addition to that, the issue of the person fighting this battle was one of the most famous people in the world. And I want to play a little bit more tape of Muhammad Ali from the time between 1967 and 1971, and how eloquent and vocal he was about why he believed he did not want to go and fight on behalf of the United States in Vietnam.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They never put no dogs on me. They never robbed me of my nationality, raped and killed my mother and father. Well, I'm going to shoot them for what? How am I going to shoot them? Them little poor little black people, little babies and children and women. How can I shoot them poor people? Just take me to jail.
And, of course, Muhammad Ali was facing the potential of having to serve 5 years in jail. Can you take us back to that time briefly and just remind us, like, what was the political climate in the United States? Because here we had the clash of civil rights, what was at one time a popular, then very unpopular war in Vietnam, and, you know, this world-renowned sports figure. I mean, what were the tensions? What was the feeling like in the late 60s, early 70s?
Well, of course, the civil rights movement was at its height. This was at about the same time that Martin Luther King began to oppose the war in Vietnam, and that made that whole issue so very controversial, and to a certain extent, it created fissures in the movement.
Now, I want to get to the legal argument that was made before the court in 1971. But before that, did you have a chance to meet Muhammad Ali when you were preparing the case?
I did. He came to the office in New York, and as you can imagine, everybody in the office found an excuse to be in the reception area at the time he came, because everybody wanted to meet him, to see him, to shake his hand. And he was an imposing figure. He was 6'3", and His hands were very large, as was his person.
Yeah. And so was it ever discussed what might happen if he lost before the Supreme Court? Because, as we mentioned, he could have gone to jail. I mean, did he tell you about how he felt about that?
Well, I think, obviously, he knew that, and he was ready to do that. And he was putting his life, his freedom, and his career on the line because of what he believed in. And that made it so important.
Yeah. So it was another lawyer, Chauncey Eskridge, who actually did the oral argument before the Supreme Court in 1971. But if I understand correctly, you wrote most of the briefs and did most of the legal preparation the day.
I think I wrote everything that was written. And, of course, although you can't see or hear me on the clip, I was sitting by Chauncey's side when the case was argued. Interestingly enough, my law school dean was Irwin Griswold arguing for the government.
No kidding. Wow. Oh, so tell us what it was like on the day of oral argument.
Well, of course, this was the first time I had ever been to the Supreme Court, and it's an imposing, very exciting. I was 30 years old at the time, maybe 31, and a young lawyer, and this was extremely exciting to be there, to be part of it.
Yeah. So summarize for us, if you could, what the basis of what ended up being the winning argument was. Why did you tell the United States that Cassius Clay and Muhammad Ali should be allowed conscientious objector status?
In order to obtain conscientious objector status, you had to be opposed to war for religious reasons. You had to be opposed to all wars rather than any particular war, and you had to be sincere. The Justice Department recommended to the board that they deny the exemption for three reasons. They said that, number one, Ali's objection to the war was political and racial and not religious. They also said that his objection was selective. He only opposed the war in Vietnam, not all wars. And finally, they said he was not sincere.
Right.
We said that all three of those reasons were wrong.
Well, we actually have tape of the oral argument made before the Supreme Court in 1971 in this case. And first, let's listen to a moment from U.S. Solicitor General Irwin Griswold. And here he is making the argument on behalf of the government along the lines of what you just said, that while he acknowledged that Ali's objection was religious, he said it was also political, which therefore he believed vacated the conscientious objector status that Ali was seeking. So let's listen.
There is in this record a basis in fact for the conclusion that the petitioner's objection, though religious, is selective. Now, that is, that he is not opposed to participation in war in any form as the statute requires, but that he is in fact opposed to fighting what he regards as the white man's wars, although having no religious or conscientious scruples against participation in war which would defend the black man's interest.
I'm wondering, hearing that now, in 2016, what does it make you think?
That it's still wrong.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because there's also a moment when Chauncey Eskridge, arguing on behalf of Muhammad Ali, basically says to the justices, like, there were a lot of hypotheticals put out there. You know, it seems as if at some point in time, the government was just looking for a scenario by which Muhammad Ali would say, yes, this is the kind of war that I agree to. But such a scenario didn't exist. And then Eskridge went on and said this.
They say that the record infers the inference that petitioner would fight tomorrow, quote unquote, in a defensive war on behalf of Muslims. This reminds us of the case of Sicarella, where the hypothetical question was put to Jehovah's Witness, what would they do if they did so and so. or if so and so and so. Now, they have taken some language, juxtaposed against other language, and they come to this conclusion. But nowhere in the record has the registrar ever said that he would fight with weapons against anybody.
It's so interesting going back and reading the transcript and listening to the argument, because a lot of what the justices questioned seemed to center on this idea of whether the objection was religious or political and how they could define where that boundary was for members of the Nation of Islam.
To a certain extent, that involved looking at the publications of the Nation of Islam. And that was really one of the things that I think had an impact on the Supreme Court. Because when the Supreme Court voted at the end of the week in which the case was argued, the vote was 5-3 to affirm the conviction. The case was assigned to Justice Harlan to write an opinion. His clerk brought to his attention a number of the works that had been cited in the briefs, the ones that had been written by Elijah Muhammad. And he, the clerk, became convinced that the principles of the Nation of Islam opposed war in any form, and he persuaded Justice Harlan that that was the case. Justice Harlan changed his vote. And when he did so, it became 4-4. An equally divided court affirms a conviction. So the court was faced with the notion of affirming Ali's, the most famous athlete in the world, conviction, sending him to jail by a court that couldn't make up its mind. And the other justices found that unacceptable, and eventually changed their vote to agree with Harlan, who was a very respected justice on the court. When the other justices changed, that left only Warren Berger as the only dissenter. And I think in the end, he decided he couldn't be the only dissenter, and the decision was unanimous.
So it went from 5-3 in against Ali to 8-0 in his favor.
Exactly.
What did it mean to you when you found out that Ali had won unanimously?
I was quite stunned. It was, as you can see from the record, one of the last decisions of the term, that particular term. And so we were waiting and waiting, and when it finally came, we were astonished.
Now, you, as we discussed, you were with the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. How much of an impact did this case have on your life and your career in the months and years afterwards?
I certainly think that the experience validated much of what I had done before and continues to validate what I've done since, because I've always continued to handle a lot of civil rights cases and criminal cases. And as I say, I think this experience and the realization that the work we did and continue to do does have an impact, not only on the life of an individual, but in this case, the life of the country.
Well, Jonathan Shapiro is a partner at Shapiro, Weisberg, and Guerin. In 1971, he was a member of the NAACP's Legal Defense Fund. And amongst his more famous victories is in the case of Clay versus the United States. That's the case we've been talking about, where Muhammad Ali asserted his right to be a conscientious objector before the United States Supreme Court and won. Mr. Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, before we take a break, we want to play just one more clip of Muhammad Ali himself. Now, the champ had been banned from boxing, as we mentioned, so while his case was being decided, Ali frequently spoke at campus anti-war rallies. And he used those speeches as an opportunity to answer a question he was so often asked. Why fight the draft when he, the greatest of all time, had so much to lose?
I would like to say that I did not lose a thing up until this very moment. I haven't lost one thing. I have gained a lot. Number one, I have gained a peace of mind. I have gained a peace of heart. I now know that I'm in content with Almighty God Himself, whose proper name is Allah. I have also gained the respect of everyone here today. As you read the newspapers and the press now, you see that I am now in court. I am in court seeking justice under the laws of the land. In this country, the United States of America, ministers are exempt from the armed services. And if they choose, I am a Muslim minister and a teacher of the religion of Islam. It has been said that I have two alternatives, either go to jail or go to the army. But I would like to say that there is another alternative, and that alternative is justice.
Muhammad Ali. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We'll be back. This is Radio Boston.